need for beds in the metro area, the number would have been much smaller. So with those kind of resources as our limiting factor, we recognize that after an event involves about 1,000 people in the metro, that we will have to make some very significant adaptations, some very significant changes in the way we provide health care, potentially setting up hospitals at convention centers, armories, what we would call an off-site care facility, also setting up potentially screening points or clinic facilities at non-clinic locations. And in the process of doing that, we would have to move healthcare providers, resources, and other things to those locations and provide care. That's unprecedented. There's not a whole lot of good law out there that tells us how to deal with that. The hospitals have agreed to volunteer physicians and nurses and other staff in order to go to those facilities and care for people, but one of the overriding concerns they have is liability protection. Minnesota has a Good Samaritan law that protects me fairly adequately if I would stop to render aid in a motor vehicle accident en route from here to my place of work. However, if I'm assigned and voluntarily assigned from my place of work to an off-site care facility, I'm still providing professional services in the context of my daily job. And the Good Samaritan Act does not cover that. And clearly, practitioners are not going to be happy and their institutions are not going to be happy about accepting liability for the provider for the institution if they are trying to further the public health response by providing those practitioners to an off-site care facility. We simply can't have liability for those providers there who are doing their best to help the community cope with what may be a tragic epidemic event. In addition, the hospitals have identified that the Emergency Health Powers Act has provided a good line of authority, a good sort of framework of operations, if you will, for a public health event, and it's very important that we understand exactly what authority exists and where, because during a health event is the last time that we want to try to be making these things up as we go along. Now, it's important for the hospitals to have consistency of response and to have consistency of planning. And time again, during tabletop drills and functional exercises around the state, the issues of command and control and authority for isolation and quarantine come up. And again, the better that we can do to establish this beforehand, the more we'll be able to effectively respond. Finally, as an emergency doc, I am responsible for caring for about 40 patients during an average 8-hour shift. Of those patients, the vast majority are very pleasant, and I have a great deal of fun actually practicing at my job, and I hope that they will go on to take the medication I prescribe for them and get better. A very few of the patients I see on a given shift aren't happy to be in my emergency department and probably won't necessarily follow through on the plan of care that we've established for them. An even smaller minority of those patients will actually take actions that would immediately threaten their health or the safety of others. And in that case, the state vests in me the power to sign a hold on those patients who I feel that mentally or chemically are at risk of making decisions for them that could kill or injure them or could kill and injure others. That's a significant power to hold, and I don't abuse that. And I have never had a complaint in retrospect, except at the immediate time I placed a hold on somebody. But in retrospect, I've never had anybody come back and say, we felt this was inappropriate, and you shouldn't have done this, and in fact, there wasn't a significant risk. And I think it's very important to draw the parallels between that sort of power that the state vests in me as a practitioner to make a judgment when somebody poses an immediate and grave risk to the public, and that some of their behaviors need to be controlled until that risk is abated by whatever means. And so again, this is not something that we're not doing on a daily basis, but on a much, much smaller scale. The current Health Powers Act language, I should note, requires a much more intensive process than what I outlined above for mental health and chemically dependent issues, and I would urge the legislature to look at strengthening the abilities of public health and perhaps practitioners to quarantine individuals to gain control of an epidemic. There's no question when we look at the data from Taiwan, when we look at the data from Singapore, from China, from Toronto, that it wasn't until aggressive quarantine and isolation measures were put in place that the SARS epidemic in those areas was controlled. Without that, without those quarantine measures, the SARS epidemic would have broadened and would have threatened the lives or killed many more individuals. The least restrictive means of quarantine should be the method that we use, and that's always what we strive to do on a daily basis in the ER. But when it comes down to it, there needs to be the authority, there needs to be the power to restrict the freedoms of individuals who would threaten others with their behavior. And to summarize, I would just urge that as the legislative session moves on, that you all would consider in the context, this bill in the context not of a sterile environment, but rather one in which we are looking at SARS. SARS is still in the world. It will be back. Pandemic influenza will probably occur during my lifetime. I think we need to make sure that we think about these in the context of a real and desperate situation, because this is exactly when this would be implemented. It's exactly that situation that this bill is designed for. And again, those powers need to be available to the public health authority in those settings. For those who would regard that as a bit alarmist to think about SARS in the community, I could certainly come up with a vast number of other bugs that are infinitely more dangerous and dramatic, smallpox, viral hemorrhagic fevers, and others. So I think SARS is a good scenario to work with, and I would urge the both legislators and public alike to consider that as we move through. Thanks again, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to testify this afternoon, and I would look forward to any questions that you or the committee members might have.
Thank you, Doctor. Any questions? Thank you. Off to work.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. So, Ms. Lighthizer, do you want to give us what's on your mind?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Aggie Lighthizer, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health, and I appreciate your flexibility in having the testimony before we go through the overview. With me today is Steve Shackman, who's a Legal Affairs Coordinator at the Minnesota Department of Health. In your packet is an overview of what we're going to go through today. We will start with reviewing the response capacities and authorities that were authorized in the 2002 Act, and also in your packet is a copy of Chapter 402 from the 2002 session, the summary of it, and a fact sheet, as well as the proposed language. The 2002 Act clarified the governor's authority to declare a public health emergency for a 30-day period. It comes into effect if the event is caused by bioterrorism or a new or novel or previously controlled or eradicated infectious disease. It also needs to have the potential of large numbers of deaths or injuries. It triggers the usual Emergency Management Act powers of Chapter 12 with a few modifications, which I'll go through. One that was added is that when a public health emergency is declared, the legislature comes into session. If they're already in session, they would stay in session. If they're not in session, the governor must convene them at the same time. And the legislature has the authority to override the governor's declaration. Some of the authorities or the tweaks that were done to Chapter 12 in 2002 included the ability to procure facilities and some supplies according to emergency plans, to enter into mutual aid agreements with tribal authorities, control the entrance or exit of persons from public places and the use of transportation, such as buses, and to transfer state agency authorities and functions to support response or recovery. It included attention to the identity and the safe disposition of the deceased, particularly after we watched the events of New York and the difficulty in identifying people. And it confirms the rights of individuals who refuse testing and treatment to do that. There are also the establishment of specific due process procedures for placing individuals in isolation or quarantine. The commissioner has the ability to issue an order that is effective immediately. Within 24 hours, the commissioner must seek court approval, and the court must either give approval or the order no longer is effective after 48 hours. There's the ability to apply for an ex parte court order, meaning that the person does not appear in court at the same time. And if the person requests a court hearing, that must be held within 72 hours, whether it's for the need for the order or for the ex parte order, or within 7 days if there's a question about concerns of the conditions of isolation or quarantine. And it confirms the subject's right to counsel. One of the requirements included as well is the conditions and care of persons ordered into isolation and quarantine, meaning their ability to communicate, the coverage of medical care, food, that the ill are separated from the well, and other conditions. Since 2002, we've done a number of things. One of the requirements of the 2002 Act was a report that was issued in February of 2003 that went through a variety of the issues at a variety of meetings, input from various public health and hospital providers, from emergency responders, and the public. The recommendations kind of fell into three basic areas with a few additional things beyond that. One was we need to understand how those powers will be used. How are you exercising them? What are your sort of plans and practices for how you're going to be going about doing that? We need to learn as we do, because what we have is a paper plan. We need to see how it works. We want to consider issues and address concerns about liability. Dr. Hick raised some issues for you. There were additional ones around volunteers. And the third, in particular, related to isolation and quarantine, was exactly how that would work, both from the court perspective of how the protocols and procedures would work, but how would a person be managed and supported and helped to be in isolation and quarantine. So in particular, in those three areas, starting with the exercises, there are 91 local public health agencies at the county or city level. 89% of them have participated in an exercise since June of 2002, and all of them must have an exercise by the end of 2004. As we sit here, the state is currently participating in Snowball 2 exercise in Minneapolis. When I left, we were up to 69 cases of pneumonic plague, and they had determined that the anthrax was not positive. So these are happening on an ongoing basis. Some of the issues that have been identified are the concerns and questions and abilities for communication and coordination, who says what to who, when, and how, sorting out roles and responsibilities. Again, the issues of supporting people in home isolation or quarantine, recruiting and managing volunteers, and as Dr. Hick described, the surge of people, large numbers of people needing emergency care. In the liability area, the issue of needing skilled health professionals to manage immediate and ongoing health issues. As we saw in the SARS outbreak, health workers are potentially victims, which means you have fewer and fewer available to help. We expect or project large numbers of ill or injured. The issues of personal protective equipment. To be effective, you must be fitted for a respirator, for something to provide you with protection. We need to be able to help people do that ahead of time, and there are very specific infection control practices, and not all healthcare workers are maybe up to speed on the particular ones that would apply. Another issue is that many potential volunteers are not employees. They may be independent practitioners or they may be retired and so don't have an employment setting. And we have additional concerns about this issue from watching the SARS outbreak, and I think it's become a much more specific concern. And then the third area is the protocols, in two areas in particular. One is in generally the public health emergency areas. We are in the midst of working on and revising our state emergency plan and local public health plans. And they are done as an all-hazards approach so that you have one plan that can be used, whether it's a chemical event or a biologic event, SARS or influenza. We have draft guidelines and public information and media plans, and this has been supported by federal funding. For isolation and quarantine, we have been working with the Ramsey County court system on a pilot basis to develop a process, to develop the protocols and procedures, to work through how the court hearings would be held, what about a defense panel? How do we help people be prepared ahead of time? And then we've also been working with state and local public health agencies on responsibilities for supporting people. How do you manage people with multiple languages? Some of the practical proposals. That's a quick overview of most, but not all, of the issues in 2002. And we would move now to some of the ideas that we're proposing.
Seems like all the weeks are busy, but this is another busy week for members of the committee, and especially members of the licensing committee. This afternoon, the subcommittee will be taking up the governor's top legislative priority in the HHS area this year, the Emergency Health Powers Act, Reauthorization Act. And tomorrow, the subcommittee will engage in a far-ranging consideration of the aspects of licensing, registration, or regulation of health-related occupations. I believe Representative Abler has already mentioned that, and he will be chairing that subcommittee. On Wednesday, as I mentioned last week, we will have a two-session hearing about the impact of regulation on nursing homes and in relation to the survey process. We will meet in the morning and probably in the afternoon as well, so to make sure that all those who are coming to testify will have the opportunity to do so. I would like to thank members for all the many meetings that we've had and being patient, and as well as House Research for their help in getting ready the bills for the subcommittee. I know there were many bills to get ready, and thank you for doing that. Today we have four bills before us, and the first one is Representative Abler's bill, and I'll let you make the case for a change in legislation. Representative Abler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just digress back to your previous comments about the hold order from the Commissioner of Health that the Commissioner can issue only if she needs that before going to court, and it's only good for 24 hours, and you have to then make application to the court. And what we need clarified is that just like a peace officer under Chapter 609 enforces a court order and uses reasonable and appropriate means, that peace officers, and we've heard this from both sheriffs and from county attorneys, need direction on what to do with the commissioner's temporary hold. And this would say two things. Enforce it as you would carry out a court order, and you can look to the commissioner of health, your local board of health, or the physician who's treating the person for this communicable disease for advice on how to protect yourself. Because that is a great concern to public safety around the state. They want to carry out the law, but they don't want to catch a disease or bring it home to their own family members. So that's in sections 9 and 10. In sections 12, there's a provision we'd like clarified on how the court may go about evidentiary hearings. Right now, subdivision 1 in 144.4195 allows for an ex parte order. That's one without notice where you won't have the person who's subject there. The court can use phone, video, electronic communications, interactive TV is something the courts are looking at. We'd like to extend that, but what we have in Section 12 to the two other kinds of hearings that might arise under this law. One would be a person who's received that order ex parte. This is their first notice. They say, no, I shouldn't be in isolation or quarantine. They have a right to get a prompt hearing. Or they accept that they've been exposed or have the disease, but they say these conditions don't meet the fair treatment standards that are in the law. I'm not getting the communications, the care, whatever it might be. So they have a right to go to court, but where someone might be infectious, there's good reasons to try and do that in a way that doesn't expose court personnel or others. And so that's why we'd like to extend these phone and video conference provisions to all three types of hearings. Finally, and this is one that is an extension of a good idea from elsewhere, is the job protection provisions for isolation and quarantine in Section 13. And we modeled this on the job protections provided for persons who the government calls upon to serve on juries. Those are in Sections 593-50 of the statutes. And basically it seeks to protect workers whether they are under an order or whether they are voluntarily, as Dr. Hick described in Toronto and elsewhere, overwhelming numbers of people there voluntarily did what was asked, over 99%. Similar numbers come from Taiwan. So that in either case, if you do what you should do, carry out your duty, that there won't be adverse consequences to you and your job. And expressly says this doesn't affect sick leave, whatever the employer-employee relationship on that governs, and it provides for a person who feels they've been wrongfully discharged or punished 90 days after they either get out of isolation and quarantine or after the action against them was taken to bring a civil suit to correct this. Moving on to volunteers, here again, one idea is one we picked up from the Emergency Management Act that since the 1950s, I believe, has said in Section 1222, Subdivision 2A, that if you come to a local government agency and you volunteer, probably thinking of tornadoes, floods, and the like, if you're...
Evaluation tools in place to document both qualitatively and quantitatively our impact on outcomes and costs. We now have initial evidence that the project is succeeding. This report from the National Center on Family Homelessness is a summary from the outcome study. It offers a snapshot of 143 participants taken from the first of three interviews, giving a pretty dramatic picture of the challenges participants face when they enter the pilot. Family and individual participants live in extreme poverty with a median monthly income of $530. The median amount of time that participants have been homeless is 24 months, with a significant subgroup homeless considerably longer. Trauma is widespread. Nearly half the participants have had a family member, friend, or partner die violently, and almost as many have been present when someone was killed or assaulted. People contend with an average of two serious health conditions, even higher rates of mental health, and significant alcohol and drug use. When we went over this information with Commissioner Goodenough, we discussed the high rates of depression, over 80%, and that over 50% of participants report schizophrenia, bipolar, or other psychotic disorders. He asked us to look further into the relationship between illness severity and people's disability status to understand where SSI and MA access might be improved.
The other idea found in Section 5, and this is, again, the extension of an idea that's been in our statute probably since the 1900s and goes back to the common law in England, is the idea of Good Samaritan. And Dr. Hick mentioned the limitation on Good Samaritans where he, leaving to play golf and stopped by another hospital to pick up a friend, and they're in a crisis. If he goes in to help, he can't possibly be a Good Samaritan under our law. It says if aid is rendered at a medical clinic or office, hospital, you can't be a Good Samaritan. What we're looking at here is your worst-case scenario, your catastrophic public health emergency, where all the hospitals and clinics are full, the corridors are filled, the temporary units are set up elsewhere. You can't handle the flow. You're in triage telling the person with a broken leg, you're going to have to sit and wait because we're trying to save lives from pneumonic plague or dirty bomb or whatever it might be. And in these cases, the Good Samaritan provision would only come in place for an area that the governor, in a separate emergency executive order, designates, saying that area is overwhelmed by the problem. It would apply to all the emergency responders, not just the people in the hospital, someone out at a mass clinic giving vaccinations or giving out drugs. And the definition of responder would be broad to cover ambulance, EMTs, and the like. And it would only be this protection for as long as that executive order says we're in this crisis. Finally, let me touch on the mentioned mass clinics, on a provision for mass clinics where, for example, in the department's smallpox planning, if a case of smallpox were detected, the objective is, as taught us by the Centers for Disease Control, is vaccinate everyone who'd be eligible for it, who doesn't have indications against it in the state, within a matter of 4 or 5 days. So talking of millions of people, we need to recruit help. Part of these volunteer efforts are just for that, and be able to either give shots or hand out drugs like the ones we were calling the anthrax mailings, Cipro, doxycycline, get these distributed at mass clinics around the state. And for that, we would like to have the authority for the commissioner to designate people additional to those who are qualified under our statutes right now to say there are other people that the commissioner will say, here's the training you need to have, here's the supervision you need to have, and you can participate in the mass clinics and help us get the medicine out to everybody in time to be effective. The last one is security data. Security data is a term that's been in the data practices law for a long time. The federal government uses the term vulnerability information. It's what you don't want the terrorists to know. For example, emergency operation plans, where the different health or emergency managers see certain weaknesses, or 24-hour pager numbers for physicians around the state who you'd call on. But there is a need to share this. The law is silent on it. We'd like to clarify that we can go to other government agency partners, including if you're in the Red River Valley, your counterparts in North Dakota or South Dakota, tribal authorities, whoever you may be working with, in order to assure that we maximize the response to the incident. So that security data provision is in Section 7 and would amend 1337 of our data practices law. Let me stop there and give it back to Aggie to summarize, unless there are questions on what I had so far. Go ahead.
Well, we have one slide of the summary of what we're proposing. First,
but all along, this is a 5-year pilot, and this just brings it into conformity with that. We know, I think, that the 06-07 is no one has a crystal ball.
And I think what you're saying, Representative Abler, is there's just no assurances of funding. It's just to assure that they would be able to continue their pilot should other monies be available. Ms. Ho, is that correct?
No, Madam Chair, yes, I understand that.
Okay. Is there any objection as far as Representative Bradley, if this would go to the consent calendar? Any other members? Representative Abler then modifies his motion that House File 2052 would be recommended to pass and would be moved to the consent calendar. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Representative Otremba, would you mind moving the minutes? Would that be okay? Representative Otremba moves adoption of the Wednesday, February 18th minutes. And he just, yes, Representative Opatz. Is there a correction?
My first name.
Well, yes, I don't know how that happened.
It's quite all right.
Probably got mixed up.
It's a fine name, it's just not mine.
I know, it is. Thanks for...
In 2000, in part, I think, because there was a federal government exercise in Denver called Top-Off that had a plague example, and they ran into certain shortcomings. That's what these exercises are supposed to teach, what doesn't work as well as what does not, what does work. So Colorado has a law that many laws were modeled, including parts of the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act that parts of our 2002 law was drawn from. And in every one of these states, there's old law and there's new law, and often it's a patchwork of both, and I'm sure we've missed a few things. I know from a call I had from North Dakota on their experience, they passed a law this past April that provides for local quarantine and state government quarantine. They also have an Emergency Management Act that we didn't get into this table, and our note on the bottom indicates that the review didn't cover all of them. It looked at the public health laws. So that gives you a little idea of where we fit in comparison with surrounding states.
Thank you, Mr. Jackman. Commissioner, anything else you want to comment on your overview? So we'll take questions now. Mr. Huntley. And by the way, Mr. Huntley is not on the subcommittee, but he's the co-author, so we're going to give him the privilege of the committee here. So.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Either one, last fall there was a federal ranking of states and how they were responding to emergency preparedness, and it was my understanding from the newspaper that Minnesota did not rank very high on that list. And I'm wondering if any of that pertained, that was response to terrorism, I don't think it was specifically bioterrorism. Have you looked at that report and analyzed how what we need to do different in the bioterrorism part?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, that was the Trust for America's Health report. They reviewed all the states and used a set of criteria and then used the information that was available at the time. We had a couple of areas that we felt maybe we were a little under-reported on. One was the expenditure or obligation of all of our funding, or 90% of our funding, by August. Well, they looked at our information the first part of September. We hadn't posted all our books. By the end of September, we were at 90%. Another issue was that at least 50% of the funding went to local public health agencies. We did not do that in the first year, but we did spend some of the money on things that supported a variety of things that were statewide. And one of the areas that we were a little crabby about was that we didn't have SARS information on our website in June. We had a lot of SARS information on our website before that. By June, the outbreak was over. We were focusing in Minnesota on West Nile. So we felt that we maybe scored better than we should have gotten a little points for that. But I don't believe that they did an evaluation of the emergency health powers or public health laws as part of their evaluation. It was more focused on the implementation of the CDC grant and the federal funding.
So Huntley,
thank you.
Okay. Other questions?
This is a good start. I just want to point out, stay there for a second, Commissioner, if you will. And
communicate with these individual institutions in 13 different languages. Can do a much better job of obtaining these verified credentials than our own board staff could do. So that's why we're here before you. As Representative Finstead has also stated, we would be lowering our application fee for the foreign medical graduates who would be required to utilize this service. Once again, I want to thank you, and I'll be happy to answer any questions the committee might have.
Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Are there any questions on behalf of members as to the bill, what the bill does? Yes, Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Finstead. So is there just a $75 fee that the applicants would have to pay, or is there another fee not listed in your bill?
Madam Chair,
Mr. Leach.
Representative Walker, the $75 charge would be the fee that they would have to pay to our board for the other application processing that we would have to still accomplish. The Federation also would charge them a fee of anywhere between, I think it's $250 to $325, depending upon the complexity of the verification process.
Of event and a small event. I think many of us with concerns have a concern about an event that's a big one but doesn't hit the category of a surge like 10,000 or 100,000 people that are involved. But when you get these small ones, and we can get concerned about power that could be carried a bit too far. And so, as I don't know how we handle that, but that's, I think you'll hear, I expect that the witnesses will offer the thought there. I think if you have a dirty bomb and a million people are involved, I don't think anybody's going to care about any of this stuff. You know, you'll just be trying to do whatever you can. But if you have 1,000 people injured and you start invoking some of these powers, and it's a little dubious where the emergency happened. Something like a snow emergency, it's 2 inches, you got to get the snow out. That's the definition of emergency. That just defines the plowing that will be done. In an emergency, it's 2 feet, you know. And nobody, they both would be termed emergency, but one's definitional, one's really a problem. So as we go on, just if you can kind of keep that in mind, and I'll attempt to keep it at that level. Any other questions for the department? Thank you, Commissioner. I'm sure you'll be standing by if anything comes up. And thank you, Mr. Shaquin. Now, there's a number of other witnesses that are here. Perhaps Anoka County wants to come down together. With that. Are you, Commissioner McCauley is here, and is Public Health going to come? Laura, are you going to, are they, Rena and Laura together? Okay. Well, you can just wait for Laura then, I guess. Or you can sit here and just keep us, come sit with us anyway. This will be Anoka County Day at the table here. One of the finest counties in the state is Anoka County. Anyway, but just for the witnesses, there's quite a supply of witnesses, I think, and I don't want to shut off good comments, but I don't want to be here till 7. But I want everybody to get their thoughts out, and so help us through, and Commissioner McCauley is especially always succinct anyway, but welcome to the committee, Commissioner. You can,
thank you, Chairman Abler. First of all, I hate to disappoint you, but my name is David McCauley. I am, in fact, an Anoka County Commissioner, but today I'm here representing the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Metropolitan Intercounty Associations. That's Rena will have to speak for Anoka County. I'll speak for those two associations. With the Association of Minnesota Counties, I'm chairman of their Health Policy Subcommittee, and emergency preparedness is an issue that we've been working on at the state level for quite a number of years. Let me say that the AMC supports the reauthorization of the Emergency Health Powers Act. It is our position that this act is necessary to clarify and strengthen Minnesota's preparedness in response to bioterrorism and other public health emergencies. Under MS-145A, we are directed to cooperate with the Commissioner of Public Health in the event of an infectious disease outbreak. As seen in the 9/11 attack, local governments are, in fact, in the front line in such a disaster. Local governments in the areas of public health emergencies and public safety emergencies are really the first responders. In such events, we need clear direction from the state as to our authority and responsibility. Since 9/11, counties have been working with the Department of Health and local emergency managers and other organizations to develop public health components of the emergency response plans, test
through them. Service cooperatives, formerly known as Educational Cooperative Service Units, or ECSUs, have a long history of doing bulk purchasing for school districts and other entities and saving them money. As the charts in front show, they currently have approximately 150,000 lives insured across the state, have 7 offices and approximately 300 employees. Their annual pooled premium volume is about $450 million, and they currently have 653 public employer groups in group health pools across the state. Additional information about service cooperatives has been provided to members in the manila folders. In the past few years, the service cooperatives have begun selling VEBA accounts, which are similar to health savings accounts. These plans have been very successful in providing another option to their members. This past year, premiums for these VEBA accounts rose at a rate in the single digits instead of the double digits as most other health insurance did, and cost about 20% less than your usual health insurance policy. Members, in this era of skyrocketing health care premiums, this bill provides one additional alternative for small businesses and other private sector concerns looking to help their employees. Many people have bemoaned the lack of competition in Minnesota in the health insurance area and tried to figure out ways to bring new competitors to the state. This bill would allow a new competitor who is already here to offer their products to the private sector.
The agency in the state that that works in the field to control disease-bearing mosquitoes, and we receive no state funding on that organization. All the funding comes from local property taxes. During the West Nile virus, we lent our expertise and field workers and did quite a bit of work to assist the Department of Health, counties, and local governments throughout the state in providing them information, training, and help that they could use because we had a lot of outbreaks throughout the state. And there is no mechanism in the Department of Health or other agencies to help cover the cost of providing that service. So from our perspective in the Mosquito Control District, it's a little unfair and sometimes very difficult when we have tight budgets to be called upon to assist other organizations and then not have any way to recover those costs. I recognize that state resources are scarce these days, but counties would expect that the legislature would not expect all costs from such response to be borne by local government. Perhaps the legislative language could include a provision for recovering local costs so that counties and cities don't get stuck with the entire bill. County resources are stretched very thin as a result of budget changes made in the last session, and our infrastructure is stretched to the point where we question whether we would be able to respond to the point in such a public health emergency with available resources. The CDC funding has helped in preparedness, but would not be sufficient in an event a response is needed. So that concludes my remarks, Mr. Chairman. Except I would like to say one of the additional areas that I also serve in is I'm a member of the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, an organization of the 50 local public health agencies throughout the state that advises the commissioner on public health matters. This group meets regularly. As a matter of fact, we're meeting later this week. And we have an ongoing dialogue with the department, and I think that helps local units of government working together with the Department of Health, forming this partnership between the state and local agencies to provide better health care and public health services throughout the state. And I think that gives us the confidence that we'll be able to work well with the Department of Health under the reauthorization of this act.
Thanks. I have a question, but hang on. Let me ask the audience a question just before we move too far. I want to ask the commissioner some questions yet. But there's ample time. We were hoping that people would take this opportunity today to talk about their concerns about the existing bill, and now that the draft has been released on Friday, about that draft. And less have signed up than I thought. This list was somewhat unclear to me. How many in the audience are going to testify today? You just raise your hands. One. All right. So actually, that we can just kind of relax our pace. I hope that those who aren't testifying today, I don't care if you testify out loud, but I need to have people's comments. Not next week. I need it this week. What you think about the bill, and about the and what we're going to work on, because the time is going to move along, and the voice you hope to have will be somewhat diluted. So that's. Just so you know, a word to the wise. So, Commissioner, I appreciate your thoughts. Can you clarify something? In the event something happened in our fair county or somewhere,
for Diane Ablers, Ehlers. That's probably not right either, is it? But please come and sit down, and you can tell us how to pronounce your name. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And I don't know if all of you are familiar with the procedure, but please, as you sit down, mention your name, tell us who you are, and we have a tape so we identify people by their names.
Thank you. My name is Diane Ehlers.
I'm Henry Minette. I'm a healthcare attorney with Lockridge Grindle Mallon that represents the Minnesota Society of Anesthesiologists.
Madam Chair and representatives,
I'm Dr. Diane Ahlers, a board-certified anesthesiologist who has practiced for the past 10 years in a Twin Cities community hospital with 16 anesthesiologists and over 40 nurse anesthetists. As a member of the Minnesota Society of Anesthesiologists, I'm here to provide you with information regarding our effort to have Governor Pawlenty reestablish Minnesota as one of the states that requires supervision of nurse anesthetists by a doctor as a condition of participation in the Medicare program.
And so it wouldn't necessarily go within the division. It would go to who is designated your local public health authority. That might be different in different counties.
And so if I can just clarify that, so it's kind of like PH, the human services that they're administered at the county level by the local public health authorities. There is no, right, is that correct? I mean, the county level local health board is the interface of the
Mr. Chairman, the Local Public Health Act, and that's Chapter 145, provides all those authorities and responsibilities, and that is your designated as a local board of health. That's your designated authority on the local level.
And so I appreciate that. And so the concern about county funding is a real concern. So if the county is unable to perform those things and there's no one to back them up except for some staff at some building in a centralized location, is that about correct?
Mr. Chairman, there'd be different resources at different levels, obviously, depending on the situation and the volume of the situation or whatever. It depends on what resources. If you have one disease prevention and control person and can handle one case, that would be one situation. If you have more than one involved situation or people involved in the situation, it can quickly escalate beyond the local resources, and that's the concern I think that what the commissioner is raising.
And this is helpful, and of course then different communities would weigh in and pull their support, but the first line of defense is the local entity, so that's helpful. Commissioner, were you on this task, on this working group to do this study that we got the report from?
No, I was not, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right, thanks. Any questions for the county? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and members, at some time we ought to get a report on what happened in Mankato, and it must be 6-8 years ago. And if I remember it right, they immunized like 16,000 people in a week. And obviously the county didn't have the staff to do that. But it was a phenomenal organization that the state set up. But, I mean, there's an example where a county couldn't possibly have done that.
Thank you. And maybe for the department, at some point we can hear about how that would be a pretty good size scale event that we could hear how we have to facilitate that. And this is productive. Anything else you want to say, Commissioner? Any questions for the... Actually, Micah, I guess I should say. Any questions for... thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And did you want to sit with Laura and do your public health thing? Are you...
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe that Laura LaCroix is listed on your on your sheets. But again, I'm Rena McManus. I'm director of the Anoka County Community Health and Environmental Services Department. However, I am here today representing the statewide local public health association and the public health directors of the Metropolitan Intercounty Association. So my remarks are based on representation of those organizations. The Minnesota Emergency Health Powers Act provides the governor, the commissioner of health, and when appropriate and necessary, the local board of health, the authority, along with the responsibility to protect the state.
Every day, nurse anesthetists will ask me questions about patients' medical problems. This morning, it was, what is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome? Complications can be severe, and the time to react may be very short. The public expects, regardless of the origin of the medical problem in surgery, that a doctor will be there to supervise the diagnosis and treatment of that problem. We can only assure the patients that we will have policies in place so a doctor is immediately available to help take care of them if something unexpected does happen. The patients in rural Minnesota assume that in 2004, Here in Minnesota, a doctor would be there to treat a complication during or after an anesthetic. Their assumption is that a standard of care any less than this would not be legal. They expect their surgeon to have both the duty and the right to be involved in taking care of their patients, especially through the most acute and dangerous period during and after an anesthetic. Governor Jesse Ventura's decision to lower the floor for responsibility in the anesthesia. A lower standard of care for rural patients now
is in which we have just done the types of things that you were questioning, Commissioner, about how could we provide mutual aid when our capacity is extended well beyond just our own resources, and how do we do that? And those are the kinds of things that we're looking at right now. Who do we call? How do we communicate? What kinds of individuals do we need to have on alert and have ready to send in the event of some large-scale situation or multiple kinds of situations? And it's been very beneficial, and I know Representative Huntley asked you about the concerns about the federal report. Those of us on the local level are also very concerned because we work very hard to try and respond to the benchmarks that were provided in those federal monies and use those monies wisely and appropriately in the kinds of things that we are preparing for. So on behalf of the organizations, I want to make two comments. First of all, we support the reauthorization. It's at a sunset time. We know that we have concerns coming about SARS as an example and pandemic influenza. We need to have those authorities in place, not just at the state level, but at the local level. But second of all, we want to address the proposed language that explicitly provides peace officers the directive to enforce isolation and quarantine orders. And most specifically, our organizations, our representatives have talked about who it is that advises on those protective measures. We support the need for advice and consult, certainly, but we have concerns with the language that speaks to allowing any physician to provide information about infectious diseases. We would suggest limiting this to the state and local public health departments. As we saw with the situations with the anthrax scares in 2001, there was a lot of different information given out at different, from a national, state, or local level, from different individuals on what would constitute the best protective measures. So maybe some more discussion and definition under that area would be appropriate. If you have different law enforcement agencies from across the state responding to an enforcement for isolation and quarantine orders, you might have different risk managers giving information to those different departments. Not sure about it, but could happen. And we want to make sure that what is put out in the public, and particularly for those individuals who are going to be on the scene then, that it's uniform and appropriate and consistent information. And so that, I don't have recommendations for the language, but that was the area where our local public health personnel had some concerns about how would this play out, who's going to give the advice for protective measures. And so I think those are the two areas that we have concerns about.
I appreciate it. And if you can, McManus, talk to your boards and give me some specific language suggestions, I would appreciate that, because that gives us something to work with, and that would help. And otherwise,
after an anesthetic, to ensure this in Minnesota, the governor needs to opt in to the federal rule. Madam Chair and representatives, thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Ahlers at this point? Mr. Minette, would you like to speak?
Yes, I would. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to address you today. Despite the glowing lead up here, I think I'm going to try and keep my remarks brief and succinct. While anesthesia reimbursement is perhaps under Medicare the most arcane of the different kinds of reimbursement. The circumstance here is actually fairly simple. Nurse anesthetists have had the right to independently bill under Medicare since 1989, and also under Medicaid as well. The change to opt out essentially has no effect on reimbursement. This is the change to opt back in. When this was considered initially, there was a lot of discussion taking place that a failure to opt out would mean that there would be a lack of reimbursement for CRNAs in rural Minnesota. This is,
you know, how will I know that I'm protected? So we know that the department is taking measures for that. We want to make sure that there's some consistency in that.
I have a question for you. You're allowed to do some holds for reasons. Have you read the language about that in here?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe that local public health authority has
well, you're given some power. So
that
you might
authority for hold. I believe that's under the Commissioner of Health.
Well, it does talk about how that a local health board can do some things. And so maybe you can, I just talked about that in private about,
okay.
Are you familiar with that? It's, I was reading it over, where the peace officer is directed to hold people based upon communication from local board of health. Mm-hmm. And I'm concerned about that as being somewhat vague. And so if, by the time we get done, I'll need some comfort about what that would look like. When the local board of health ask a peace officer to hold somebody based upon some decision that's a good idea, who would that be? And maybe not for today's meeting, but mm-hmm. Does that amount to a clerk there? Does that amount to the whole board has to get together and vote on it? Is the lead person going to put that out as being the decision of the local board of health? And so in terms of how that would flesh out, given a real situation, who has the authority there? And some of these holds, in my mind, are a little concerning about they may have been exposed to something that could be harmful. And so, given some inappropriate use of it, I have concerns about that. I have no problem if there's a big outbreak, like we talked about the 2-foot snowfall. And so my concerns are in that avenue would probably be on the scope of today, but if you can work with that and we can talk, I'd
certainly
be much obliged about
that.
Any questions for the public health members? Thank you very much. Now we have Tom Pritchard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Identify yourself.
Tom Pritchard, Minnesota Family Council. We were involved in this issue a couple years ago and I guess raised some of the concerns we had then and also on the subsequent proposals here. And some of these are just questions, but I think things we'd like to see the committee alerted to. I guess the context we saw the original bioterrorism threat, public health emergency introduced was in the context of that there was going to be a significant public health threat and there was going to be a declared emergency. And yet we saw some provisions added to the law which weren't tied in there, and we think that maybe some of those things should be. And let me just raise some questions, concerns. I just got a few points and then I'll leave you folks alone. The first is, it's not in the bill, but under section 1230.32, the governor's orders and rulemaking authority have the full effect of a force of law. And it talks about allowing the governor to, in a sense, suspend the current law. And I guess we have some questions as to whether or not that would apply to provisions which are intended to are tied into the health emergency. Could he suspend even those provisions, like, for instance, the right of people to refuse treatment?
Madam Chair?
Mr. Minette.
Originally, when this rule was passed, it did provide for the study of the impact of the rule in states which opted out. The federal government, for some reason, didn't seem fit see fit to fund that study. So as far as we're currently aware, despite the fact that everyone would have an interest in knowing, you know, what the impact is, there have been no formal studies, to our knowledge, anywhere in the country.
Okay. Representative Powell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Abstinenti's studies, do you have any anecdotal evidence that physicians are complaining, even privately amongst themselves, about the services that the CNRAs are providing?
Dr. Ahlers.
Unfortunately, I don't have the interaction with the rural surgeons in that regard, because my practice is here in the Twin Cities, so I wouldn't have, and I haven't gone out and done a personal survey of them. Maybe the question is whether or not the patients, and asking our constituents and our patients in the rural, if they realize that they don't have any longer a doctor taking care of them when they're having an anesthetic, that now it is just a nurse. And maybe that's where we need to really ask our question.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming. Deborah Boardman will start us on another vein. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Deb Boardman, and I'm the President and CEO of Riverview Healthcare Association in Crookston, Minnesota. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association, and I thank you for the opportunity to express our support of Minnesota's opt-out position regarding the supervision of CRNAs. For those of you that have never been to Crookston, let me explain to you what kind of a rural area that is. We're in the far northwest corner of the state. We're approximately 30 miles from Grand Forks, North Dakota. And I would say we come from what is classified as a pretty large rural facility. We are defined as a critical access hospital, which is a federal designation that assures that people receive access to health care. We have 25 beds, we have an attached nursing home, and we have 18 active medical staff, including three orthopedic surgeons, one general surgeon, and a podiatrist that do procedures within our facility. And we do roughly 1,800 surgeries a year and are served exclusively by CRNAs. There's a nationwide shortage of both anesthesiologists and CRNAs, but the situation is much more acute in sparsely populated areas of the country, including the Midwest. Because of the shortage, many rural hospitals have relied exclusively on the services of CRNAs to provide anesthesia during surgery, and I know that you'll be getting a list of those later. I personally have always only worked in facilities that have CRNA exclusive coverage, and when this issue came up, I've asked myself, what problem is it we're trying to solve here? I can tell you that the facility I'm in now, I went back when this issue first came up, and I went back to our quality assurance director, who has been in our facility for 10 years. And I asked her to go back and research if in our facility we have ever had an adverse incident related to anesthesia, and I'm proud to tell you that we have had none. Now, this doesn't mean that it couldn't happen with or without an anesthesiologist, because unfortunately medical errors do occur, but we have had none in our facility. And I think part of this is because rural hospitals have historically been very conscientious about what types of patients we can safely serve in our facilities. Our physicians are acutely aware that we have CRNAs and they rely on them. And when patients are beyond what they believe to be either the CRNAs or their own capabilities, they are sent to larger facilities. For many years, Medicare has required that a medical doctor supervise CRNAs. That supervision could come from an anesthesiologist or the operating surgeon. This supervision policy has become increasingly controversial as CRNAs have become technically more competent over time. In response to that, President Bush and his administration felt that the state should be able to make the decision over whether CRNAs should be supervised and created the opt-out policy. Our information says that 10 states, you've heard 12 today, but our information has said 10, and those are Iowa, Nebraska, Idaho, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Kansas, North Dakota, Washington, Alaska, and Minnesota. And since opting out, none of these states have reported additional adverse outcomes and have kept their opt-out status. The Minnesota Hospital...
Anybody else who desires to testify about this today? Perhaps I can recall Commissioner Lighthizer to come back then and we can have a bit of a dialogue. And okay. And, yeah, you may both come up. I actually, just for this, so you can not be caught blind, since we're kind of running ahead of where I thought we would be, I'll reiterate to people in the audience who have friends who care about this to please get me some thoughts. The next meeting will be if you, the testimony would be very brief, if you have thoughts, it would be very succinct, and it'd be, half the work would be written by then, so I suggest that you move along. Members, I just want to tell you a few of my concerns. You're aware that I spent a good deal of 2 years ago fighting this whole project, my good friend Repson Huntley encouraged me to not fight it. We came up with a compromise, and what you see in front of you is that, and I think it's a good thing we did something. And some of my concerns are still present, and so I wanted to let you have the benefit of those thoughts in a respectful way. And Mr. Huntley, I have not spoken, so we will you'll hear them for the first time, too. It's basically the thing about the 2-foot snow versus the 2-inch snow. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to find a way to struggle with that. But I'll give you a few specifics about the language you've introduced. On page 3.
Hospital Association strongly supports keeping Minnesota as an opt-out state and urges Governor Pawlenty to keep the status quo and not opt back into the supervision rule. I can tell you that the orthopedic surgeons in my facility have written letters to Governor Pawlenty asking him to continue to support the opt-out option. And I know if any of you have ever worked with orthopedic surgeons, they are the very, very particular people due to the nature of the work that they do. And the letters of support that they have sent have very glowingly given references on the CRNAs that they work with in our facility, and they have no concerns. From a practical standpoint, rural surgeons have traditionally provided supervision of CRNAs in name only anyway. The CRNA was responsible for the selection, the dosage, and the delivery of the anesthetic, and that's what the surgeons rely on them to do. Surgeons practicing in rural Minnesota are increasingly unwilling to provide supervision of CRNAs. Rural surgeons want the CRNAs to be responsible for the anesthetic delivery. Hospitals are fearful that if surgeons don't want to provide that supervision and CRNAs are required to be supervised, hospitals will be forced to recruit anesthesiologists who, as cited above, are in short supply, or hospitals will be unable to provide surgical care to patients in their community, which certainly is the key to the availability of many of the core services in community hospitals, such as your OB services. It's important to also note that for many rural hospitals, surgical procedures may be the only profitable service which is offered by the hospital. These revenues gained are there to provide surgical procedures would allow rural hospitals to maintain the other areas, such as emergency rooms, labor and delivery, and other vital hospital services that do not show a profit. Little has changed since the opt-out policy was adopted. However, I am fearful that reverting back to a CRNA supervision requirement would have a negative impact on the rural hospitals and the patients that we serve. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Boardman. Are there questions for Ms. Boardman? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know, you may have hinted at it because you said you're not sure how much changed, but I wondered whether hospitals have adjusted their charges based on who's actually providing these kind of services. If a CRNA is being empowered to do more and we don't have to have an anesthesiologist there, it would seem like maybe the cost would be reduced. Have we seen any effect on charges?
Ms. Boardman.
Madam Chair, Representative, when you look at the charging system for health care, you're all pretty aware that it's a pretty complicated way of doing things. I think you may have seen some adjustments. Typically, anesthesia is either lumped in with a surgical charge or it is billed out on an incremental time schedule. I don't know that you've seen the charges increase for CRNAs acting on their own. However, I do know that the comments made earlier about this would not cause Medicare or Medicaid to pay more, in fact, may not be true in some cases. You'll hear a little bit more about that later, but specifically in the areas where hospitals such as myself, where we're critical access hospitals, we are cost-based reimbursed, which means both Medicare and Medicaid pay us on a cost-based reimbursement. If it should cost us more to pay a supervising physician to supervise a CRNA, those will be additional costs on the system.
And that was mentioned by one of the witnesses. On line 16, it will, the government entity, which is somewhat of a, is that defined in the bill? I don't know. Can make data available to anybody that really wants in another government if they think it will aid public health. And what wouldn't washing hands will aid public health? So, I mean, that's a pretty low threshold. To promote public safety, Mr. Stanek will advise that many things will aid public safety. assist law enforcement. Those are terms that are relatively ill-defined in terms of when you would release that data. It's a very low threshold for, and it may not be what you mean, and so that could be tightened up, I think, to say what you really want that information to be used for. Just so you're probably aware of it gets a little controversial about data and who gets what. You maybe remember that discussion from before, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, yes, I have heard that.
Yeah.
And to be clear, this is not personal health data.
Right.
It's security information.
Well, any data classified as security information. And so we'll have to maybe clarify what that.
And there is a definition of security information, so we could maybe work on that.
So this is my own concerns, that the draft is relatively new.
Yes.
And I just want to make sure you're not caught blind on this, and so we're trying to be productive here.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
And now back to what I asked.
Was it last summer? Well, you organized your team, and we had a very good discussion and tour of your hospital. Thank you for coming today.
It was our pleasure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lori Whiteman. I'm the president of New Ulm Medical Center. New Ulm Medical Center is a 62-bed hospital that employs 490 individuals, including 30 physicians. The New Ulm Medical Center is truly a full service community hospital. We provide inpatient and outpatient mental health and substance abuse services, obstetrics and newborn care, outpatient cardiac diagnostic services, rehab, chemo, and orthopedics. The hospital also owns and operates home health care, hospice, and ambulance services. Thank you for allowing me to present my position on the CRNA supervisory issue. I want to focus my remarks in two specific categories, physician supervision and CRNA scope of practice. In physician supervision, as you know, Minnesota has opted out of the federal Medicare requirement for physician supervision of CRNAs. Opting back into the requirement would mandate physician supervision. And let me explain why this would be problematic for New Ulm Medical Center. New Ulm is located in southwestern Minnesota. I've spoken with our surgeons about CRNA supervision, and none of them want the responsibility for supervising a CRNA, and here's why. CRNAs have very specific and extensive training on administrating anesthesia. The operating room physicians I've spoken with do not feel that they have been given specific education about anesthesia, and therefore they do not feel they are qualified to supervise CRNAs. Because we are a small rural facility, our volumes would not be able to generate the income needed to recruit an anesthesiologist to practice in our facility. Although we would welcome Dr. Allers back home, if surgeons are unwilling to provide CRNA supervision, we'd be unable to provide surgical care to our patients. Secondly, I want to point out why I believe the current model works. CRNAs are not performing services that are outside of their scope of practice. In New Ulm, like many other rural communities, we do not do complex surgeries where surgeons would want the availability of an anesthesiologist, such as heart surgery. We have limited ourselves for a number of reasons to performing less complex procedures that can undoubtedly be provided by CRNAs. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague, John Kahns, a CRNA and member of the Minnesota Board of Nurse Anesthetists, who will address the issues of patient access and collaborative care teams.
Mr. Kahns. Madam Chair and representatives, my name is John Kahns. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist in the state of Minnesota. I thank you for allowing me to testify. First of all, I want to speak to you about limited patient care access. If Minnesota changes its status on CRNA supervision, I believe it will have a major impact on patients.
Mm-hmm. Such. There may be some people that wanted to comment that didn't even know that this was the time to comment, and I'm not sure we'll broaden that scope much with this august audience here and the broad range we get here. But I still would urge people to bring forward their thoughts, and we're open to that, and to make it better, much like we talked about the agent business and so on. Um, So I think you've heard my thoughts. Any members want to offer any additional concerns or thoughts as we get close to being done here for the day? Oh, and maybe you could talk about the sunset. I, for one, kind of liked the sunset, and the you, for one, didn't like the sunset. So if you want to take a minute and comment about that, I'd appreciate that, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, the original bill that was passed in 2002 had a sunset date of August of 04. So one of the reasons that we're here this session is because of that sunset date. Our recommendation from the administration was to remove the sunset date, and if there are issues and concerns, to bring them up through the legislative process, and rather than come back every year or two to talk about everything in detail again, Mr. Chair.
Well, Commissioner, we like seeing you. So it's and maybe that 2 years might be rather short, and certainly we have to do something about the sunset now. So that's
such as the Blues, Health Partners, and etc. Thank you for listening to my remarks, and we'd be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Members, do you have any questions for Ms. Whiteman or Mr. Kahns? Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe Mr. Kahns, but actually just trying to piece together some of the items from testimony. Ms. Whiteman said something about we do not do complex surgeries where surgeons would want the availability of an anesthesiologist. And the question to that one is, who decides when you need an anesthesiologist or not? And then the other is, there's been mention about scope of practice. And I wonder if you could give us kind of a for instance about where does the line get drawn on scope of practice as far as whether it's complexity of surgery or whatever else it may be that to try to help that. Those two questions are kind of related.
Mr. Kahns.
Madam Chair and Representative. Our scope of practice deals with the safety of the care of the patient, how we provide anesthesia to our patients, and standards that are set by the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and I'd be willing to provide that information to the committee if they would like to have that information in writing.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I'm not today going to try to get into all the complexity, but could you give me a for instance of when it would not be appropriate and within the scope of practice and the use of anesthesia
for Mr. Kahns.
Registered nurse?
Madam Chair and Representative, in regard to your question about when we need an anesthesiologist and when we don't need an anesthesiologist in the practice, in rural Minnesota, I believe that it would be very impractical for us to get an anesthesiologist. And to answer your question more precisely about procedural, I would say that we probably look at, you know, open hearts for team care, in big vascular cases, neuro cases, those types of things.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe just to go back to my first part of the question, which Ms. Whiteman, I think it was you that mentioned. Not using or complex surgeries, who has the authority to decide whether or not for that particular operation or whatever it may be, to decide whether or not it would be a nurse anesthetist or an anesthesiologist?
Ms. Whiteman.
Madam Chair, Representative Bradley, that decision is similar to the decisions that we make on an almost daily basis of what kind of patients we take into our facilities and what needs to be transferred for care that we don't necessarily provide in our community hospital. And that's what starts with the primary care physician or the physician in charge or the attending, knowing what the capabilities of not only in the operating room but also post care, post-op care, what's going on. And
if we get done, we get done. If we have to carry this over, we will. And so Mr. Huntley and I sit down, we'll put our heads together, and if the department has specific ideas of how they can pick up some of the concerns and express to me that I'm wrong, I'm happy to hear that. And if I'm right, I'm glad to hear that too. And other members that have concerns, or bring them to either of us, or and if you have specific line and page ideas, bring those forward. So it'll be about a half hour after session on Monday, and we'll proceed. Tomorrow's hearing is an entirely different topic. It has to do with licensure boards. And we hope to hear as many of those bills as we can get done. It's my intention, it'll be in room 300 North at 3 o'clock tomorrow. It'll be done for sure by 4:30 because there's a caucus. And so we'll get as far as we can. It's my intention to hear each bill, amend it up as we can, and then lay it on the table temporarily to be put into, perhaps your omnibus. We're going to be use the Department of Health licensing bill as a vehicle to handle all those licensing bills. So thank you for your generosity, Commissioner, about that. Mm-hmm. And we looked at the suspension of that bill and discovered it was overbuilt, that there's very strong wheels on that bill, and so it'll carry a little bit more load. So thanks for that. And any other comments that would improve the good of the order? Commissioner, yes.
Mr. Chair, you asked for us to tell you when you were right.
Okay.
And one issue that you didn't bring up that you had asked about was the definition of communicable disease for isolation and quarantine.
I'm guessing your question is about we've limited ourselves. Is that? We've limited ourselves for not only not having the availability of an anesthesiologist, but we limit ourselves for the skill and comfort level of our ICU nurses, what kinds of things we can do in post-op care as well. So it's not just limiting because of anesthesia. It's also what are the skills and how often would we be doing certain procedures so that the whole care team can keep their skills up.
Okay, and one more
Representative
question.
Dempsey.
You know Terry?
Terry.
Do you know Terry Dempsey?
Ms. Whiteman or Mr. Kunz?
Madam Chair, yes, I do.
Oh, okay. Well, when you see him, say hi to him before he cut it off.
Any other questions? Seeing none, well, thank you for your testimony today and for coming to St. Paul.
Thank you.
Thank you. George Gerlach. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
You've traveled a distance today, too.
Just a little bit. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Gerlach, and I'm the administrator of the Granite Falls Hospital and Manor in Granite Falls. On behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association, I want to thank you for the opportunity to express our support for Minnesota opt-out position regarding the supervision of certified registered nurse anesthetists. Granite Falls Municipal Hospital and Manor is a small rural facility with critical access hospital status. We rely exclusively on CRNAs for anesthesia delivery. Our medical staff is made up of 4 family physicians, a certified nurse practitioner, and a physician's assistant. Our surgeon comes from Montevideo, approximately 14 miles away, operates in our facility about a day and a half a week, and then covers emergency call. To answer some of your questions before I go on with my planned testimony, there were a couple of questions I maybe can clear up. One is how we limit what we do in hospitals. All physicians in hospitals are credentialed by the medical staff, and those credentials are approved by the board of directors. So once those procedures are listed out that they want to do, their peers on the medical staff and the board approve those. So that's how a practice would be limited. And as to how CRNAs work in a facility, they are allied members of our medical staff and are also credentialed as our physicians. And so, therefore, their practice is critiqued and approved by the medical staff and the board of directors. So hopefully that will clear up a couple of your earlier questions. We have a relationship with a regional facility because we're a critical access hospital. And any complicated procedures would probably be referred there first, if not on to the Twin Cities. Our surgeon is a general surgeon, and as I said, he has a limited scope of practice outlined by the medical staff to general surgery and some orthopedics. You heard in previous testimony that there's some concern that surgeons don't want to supervise. I have maybe a unique situation in my facility. In the past, my surgeon did supervise our CRNAs, and I believe he'd be more than willing to do it if we were to ask him in the future. However, I do believe that he would charge us for that supervision, whereas in the past he did not. And that relates to the economics of medical practice in today's economy. And that goes directly to one of the comments you heard earlier, that this would not increase the cost. I believe it would in small rural facilities. If we pay our surgeons to supervise our CRNAs, that would add to the cost. On behalf of our small rural hospitals, the Minnesota Hospital Association conducted a survey, which I would like to share with you. That survey found that 80 out of our 139 hospitals rely exclusively on CRNAs. Further, it's estimated that a total of 70,000 surgical procedures are performed at these hospitals every year. CRNAs enable rural hospitals to provide access to surgical care. I would also like to pass out a letter to you on behalf of the Minnesota Hospital Association's Small and Rural Hospital Committee. That is made up of 30 administrators and CEOs from small rural hospitals. The committee strongly supports keeping Minnesota's opt-out position status quo. Nationwide, the opt-out position has worked effectively since 2001 and has not jeopardized patient safety or led to a rise in adverse outcomes. Reversing this position would result in a loss of access to care. And thank you for your consideration, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can.
Are there any questions for Mr. Gerlach? Thanks for clearing up some of those issues, and thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Linda Huber. And I believe there's a letter in your packets from Ms. Huber. And there's others joining you today.
Yes.
Good. You can all introduce yourselves.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair Boudreau and representatives of the Health and Human Services Policy Committee. I'm Linda Huber. I'm a certified registered nurse anesthetist, and I'm also president of the Minnesota Association of Nurse Anesthetists. I have 26-plus years' experience as a CRNA in the Twin Cities. I am currently employed at Regents Hospital. I represent the 1,179 certified registered nurse anesthetists of Minnesota. Accompanying me today are Rick Juneman, who practices in Marshall, Minnesota, and also Brian Hunter, a CRNA of Moose Lake. Also behind us is Shirley Brecken from the Board of Nursing, and if you have any additional questions, she is available also. I'd like to present just a very brief history and perspective of anesthesia in Minnesota and the U.S. Nurses were the first professional group to provide anesthesia services in the United States. Established in the 1800s, nurse anesthesia has been since recognized as the first clinical nurse specialty. Surgeons saw nurses as a cadre of professionals who could give their undivided attention to patient care during surgical procedures. Serving as pioneers in anesthesia, nurse anesthetists became fully involved in the full range of specialty surgical procedures, as well as in the refinement of anesthesia techniques and equipment. The most famous nurse anesthetist in the 19th century, is Alice McGaugh. She worked at St. Mary's Hospital in the year 1889 in Rochester, Minnesota. She worked with the Mayo brothers, and Dr. Charles Mayo conferred upon Alice the title of Mother of Anesthesia for her many achievements in the field of anesthesiology, particularly her mastery of open drop technique and her subsequent publishing of her findings. In 1909, formal education programs to prepare nurse anesthetists were established. Since World War I, nurse anesthetists have been in the principal anesthesia providers in combat areas in every war in which the United States has been engaged. Nurse anesthetists have been held as prisoners of war, suffered combat wounds during wartime, and have lost their lives serving their country. The names of two CRNAs killed in Vietnam are engraved on the Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. Minnesota CRNAs have recently served in the Iraq War. Several were in the combat area of Baghdad and have since returned to the state. Founded in 1931, the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists is a professional association representing more than 28,000 CRNAs nationwide. The ANA developed and implemented a certification program in 1945
instituted mandatory recertification in 1978. It established a mechanism for accreditation of nurse anesthesia educational programs in 1952, which has been recognized by the U.S. Department of Education since 1955. Today, the CRNA credential is well recognized as an indicator of quality and competence. The education and experience required to become a CRNA is as follows: a bachelor's degree of science in nursing or other appropriate baccalaureate degree, a current license as a registered nurse, at least 1 year's experience in an acute care nursing setting, graduation from an accredited school of nurse anesthesia. These educational programs range from 24 to 36 months depending on university requirements and offer a master's degree. All programs include clinical training in a university-based or large community hospital. Pass a national certification exam following graduation. It takes a minimum of 7 calendar years of education and experience to prepare a CRNA. The average student nurse anesthetist works at least 1,600 clinical hours and administers more than 790 anesthetics under the supervision and mentoring of a CRNA or other physicians of anesthesia. There are 4 schools of nurse anesthesia in Minnesota: Mayo, St. Mary's University of Winona, Minneapolis School of Anesthesia, and the Minneapolis Veterans Medical Center, which is now going to be affiliated with the University of Minnesota. As I said before, there are 1,179 CRNAs in Minnesota who provide anesthesia services at approximately, now our numbers may be different from the Hospital Association, we believe there's 146 sites. These sites include urban and rural hospitals, traditional surgical suites, obstetric delivery rooms, critical access hospitals, ambulatory surgery centers, the offices, dentists, podiatrists, ophthalmologists, radiologists, fertility clinic, plastic surgeons, and the VA. There are 97 hospitals in Minnesota that rely solely on CRNAs for all their anesthesia needs, enabling these healthcare facilities to provide obstetrical, surgical, and trauma stabilization services. Certified registered nurse anesthetists provide a full range of anesthesia services, general anesthesia, regional and local, in accordance with the Advanced Nurse Practice Law of 1999 of Minnesota. The Advanced Practice Nurses Law states that Minnesota CRNAs work in collaboration with physicians, dentists, and podiatrists. All parties agreed upon this language when this law was published. When anesthesia is administered by a nurse anesthetist, it is recognized as the practice of nursing. When practiced by an anesthesiologist, it's recognized as the practice of medicine. CRNAs administer anesthesia for all types of surgical cases, from the simplest to the most complex. The CRNA stays with the patient for the entire procedure, constantly monitoring every important vital function of the body of that patient and individually modifying the anesthetic for each patient to ensure maximum safety and comfort. According to the Institute of Medicine's report published in October of 1999, anesthesia care today is nearly 50 times safer than it was just 20 years ago. The Minnesota Department of Health published a study in 1992 that stated there were no significant differences in outcomes of anesthesia, whether provided by a CRNA, an anesthesiologist, or when anesthesia was practiced together in the team concept. The most recent study, the PINE study, was a compiling of 404,000 cases that took place from 1995 to 97 in 22 states. These were cases that were anesthesia was provided by CRNAs and physician anesthesiologists, and they were looking at the death rates of Medicare patients undergoing surgery. The results revealed that the patients are just as safe receiving their anesthesia care from CRNAs or anesthesiologists working individually, or from CRNAs and anesthesiologists working together. In January of 2000, after 3 years of careful consideration, Medicare proposed removing the federal physician supervision requirement for nurse anesthetists. This was to be published in the Federal Registry that week, the last week of the Clinton administration. The Bush administration put all legislation on hold upon taking office and instead implemented the cumbersome rule that was enacted now of November of 2001.
The new rule allows state governors to opt out of federal supervision requirement via a written letter to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, which is CMS. Prior to sending such a letter, a governor must consult with the state boards of medicine and nursing and determine that removal of the supervision requirement is in the best interest of the citizens of that state, and determine that opting out of the requirement is consistent with state law. Both the American Hospital Association and the National Rural Health Association supported Medicare's initial proposal to drop the supervision requirement across the board. There are 12 states that have opted out. Iowa, Nebraska, Idaho, Minnesota, New Hampshire, New Mexico, Kansas, North Dakota, Washington, Alaska, Oregon, and Montana as of last month. No state has reversed the opt-out ruling. The opt-out ruling has clarified the physician-CRNA relationship as these two medical entities work in a collaborative relationship. And this is how it's reflected in Minnesota law. This opt-out does not provide additional financial reimbursement for the CRNA. One illustration of what this opt-out means for Minnesota citizens is reflected in our rural hospitals. If the opt-out were reversed, rural hospitals would have a much more difficult time recruiting surgical and obstetrical physicians. The opt-out reduces the confusion about supervision and liability issues for surgeons. There is no compelling reason to reverse the opt-out. The rule complies with state law. There have been no reported adverse outcomes since the opt-out was enacted in all 12 states. The entire community of Minnesota nurse anesthetists is proud of the record of providing quality anesthesia care to Minnesota citizens. The 1,179 CRNAs of Minnesota go to work each day to provide safe anesthesia care to Minnesota citizens, whether they live in the city or in the rural areas of the state. These CRNAs are available 24/7 to deliver high-quality anesthesia, and this is what the citizens of this state expect when they need these services. The opt-out is a perfect fit for Minnesota, and I urge you all to concur. I thank you so much for your time. Thank you. And now I'm going to refer to my other colleagues.
Mr. Juneman or Mr. Hunter, did you wish to say anything?
Very short. Much of what I was going to say has already been covered, so I'm going to go away from my prepared notes and just talk a little bit about my practice. I've been a CRNA for 23 years and practiced in about 14 rural hospitals in southwest Minnesota. I am there. I love being there. I agree with the term Greater Minnesota. It indeed is a great place to be from. People need access to health care. It will be diminished without CRNAs and other allied health providers out there. The anesthesiologists cannot come up and out there and make the money they're used to making. They're not going to come. The surgeons that we talk to and are recruiting don't want to be responsible for anesthesia. They're trained differently now than they were 30 and 40 years ago. They don't have much contact and learn much about anesthesia. My OBGYN providers and family docs don't do epidurals and don't do interfecals, but my small group of anesthetists cover Marshall and surrounding hospitals 24/7, giving our ladies pain relief for labor and delivery. If they didn't have it, I guarantee you today's woman will go to Sioux Falls, will go to Minneapolis, or go elsewhere where they can get intrathecals and obstetrics. We CRNAs provide that care, and we do it well. We're well trained to do it. We're a vital part of the healthcare community in rural Minnesota, and I repeat, the physicians don't want to supervise us. They're more than happy to call up at 2 in the morning and say, Rick, would you come in and do an epidural on this lady? And they're calling from home. They don't want to supervise us. They don't want to be responsible for us. In Marshall, our cases range. This past year, I've done babies from 6 months old to old people, elderly people, 85, 90 years old for total joint replacement. I've done carotid ectomies, big vascular cases. We do a large spectrum of cases. We do know when we shouldn't practice. I think it was a gentleman from over here, excuse my name, Madam Chair, but we visit with the surgeons when they have a question. Should we be doing this patient? This past year, we absolutely refused, even though the surgeon wanted to do a case in Marshall because we weren't confident we could manage the airway. The patient had a stabilized neck fusion, couldn't move any more than this. We didn't want to risk intubating that patient or putting the patient to sleep and failing to manage the airway, so we deferred the case to a metropolitan hospital where they're more equipped to handle compromised airways. There was a question regarding who is appropriate to provide anesthesia for what case. If I was in the Twin Cities, there are CRNAs who have done vascular and open heart anesthesia for 20 years. A 20-year CRNA is as good at doing an open heart case as an anesthesiologist. But it's appropriate to use anesthesiologists also. You know, the team approach works very well in the Twin City metro area. They don't want to come to our area. There's a question of cost to hospitals. If we had an anesthesiologist come to Marshall, they would get 50% of any case being done. So we get $16.82 per unit, or some figure like that. Now the hospital employed CRNA would only get $8 per unit, and the anesthesiologist would get $8. So there would be a direct cost to the hospital. I will conclude my notes simply by, I get to read my conclusion. All the rest of my conversation I diluted because it's been talked about. But in 12 states, if the opt-out has been successful, no state has reversed it. The opt-out allows CRNAs to practice in accordance to law. It allows surgeons to do what they're skilled at doing, surgery, and not having to work and worry about the anesthesia at the head of the bed. I'll tell you what, if I'm having surgery, I want my surgeon to be concentrating on surgery. Let the anesthesia provider do the anesthesia, and I think that's very important. It allows patients to have surgery in their hometown and keeps the hometown healthcare dollars in the hometown. I think those are very important points. And one person said, somebody famous once said, if it isn't broke, don't fix it. I suggest, I would encourage all of you to counsel the governor and encourage him to leave the opt-out as it is. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Hunter, did you have a comment?
Madam Chair, I'll be brief too. I think everything's been said. The only additional thing that I can add is I was educated in my anesthesia training through the U.S. Army, and the way the government works is that as an Army CRNA, I was trained to be in a forward surgical team that would drop behind enemy lines and provide anesthesia care all by myself in the middle of austere conditions. And as a rural anesthetist, we work in a place that we have some limited resources. And if it was good enough for our Army soldiers to have myself go all over the world without anesthesiologists, without physician supervisions, it certainly should be good enough for the members of our fine state. The other thing that I wanted to add that I thought that was important, the problem that I see with reversing the opt-out is it'll start some confusion with some of the surgeons that we work with. I'm from Mercy Hospital in Moose Lake. We're a critical access hospital, a small community-based hospital that uses some itinerant surgeons from Duluth. And one of my concerns would be that if we reverse the opt-out, they will all of a sudden think that the opt-out deals with supervision and that there will be increased liability to working with nurse anesthetists down in Moose Lake. And we're not talking about a liability issue. We're talking about a reimbursement issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from committee members? Thank you very much for coming today, your testimony. Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to testify that did not have the opportunity to do so? Come forward, Ms. Brecken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to offer testimony, but I can answer two of the questions that were asked earlier. Representative Powell, I believe you asked a question about accountability in reference to the CRNA and the operating physician. The answer that I give you is that the Board of Nursing and the law hold the CRNA accountable for his or her own practice. The individual is licensed by the Board of Nursing, and in Minnesota, in order to practice as a CRNA, is required to have national certification. And that means that they must practice according to that scope of practice and meet those standards of practice as identified.
Excuse me. Would you please introduce yourself and who you represent?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm Shirley Brecken, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing.
Thank you.
The second question was yours, Representative Boudreaux. You asked a question about has the board received complaints about CRNAs since the opt-out was implemented in Minnesota, and the answer is no. The board has not had any complaints filed against CRNAs
due to a lack of physician supervision or removal of that requirement of physician supervision since April of 2002 when it was implemented.
Thank you for answering that question. Do members have other questions for Ms. Brecken? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Members, at this point, we've received all the testimony that we intend to today on this issue, and what I can tell you we'll do is we'll pass on the points that have been made as well as the handouts and with a drafted letter to the governor's office as to what we heard. And if you have additional comments, things you'd like to pass on to the governor's office, you may do so as well. At this point, there is no further business. The committee is adjourned.